Okay, so this morning, I'm going to start by talking about Zen Center's mission. And I only have this on my mind because we had a little meeting last week to consider what our mission should be. An interesting question. Well, then on my way home from that meeting, I was thinking, I'm the guiding teacher here. what's my mission? And I don't think this should probably become our mission statement, by the way. but my mission really is to help people enjoy being, and so that we don't have to focus so much on being smart or being right or being rich or being loved, because we can enjoy being. That's really my focus. That's why I'm here every day, to help people do that. I don't think it would make a good mission statement, though. In Zen, we say whole being Buddha nature. Whole being Buddha nature. Anyway, that's the that's why I do this. Why I do this. The means. When we were meeting with our mission consultant, I was saying, well, this is about Zen meditation. And she said, well, that's the means. You should think about what the end is. The means is Zen meditation. That's the means. That's the means to doing this, to learning how to just settle into being, whatever the situation is, wherever we are, whatever our feeling is, whatever our state of mind is. So that's the means. It's Zen meditation. And Buddhist meditation is very old. People have been doing it for a long time in lots of different contexts. And the word Zen, as most of you know, comes from Chan, which comes from Jhana. It all means meditation. And in Pali, there's something which some of you know called Satipatthana. And there's a Satipatthana Sutra. Sati and Satipatthana. Sati means attentiveness to the present, awareness, wakefulness. That's meditation practice. And patana means close, firm, and steadfast. So close, firm, and steadfast, attentiveness to and awareness of the present. Satipatthana, Zen meditation. I don't see any difference. And where I disagree, though, is when it's and 95% of the time it's referred to as mindfulness. I disagree with that for one reason, and that is that this is not about memory. It's not about memory. It's memory of the past. Like, you want to remember where you put your shoes, right? And you should learn to remember, but Zazen is not going to help you do that. If you think Zazen is going to help you do that, you're going to be very disappointed. That's not what Zazen is about. It has nothing to do with memory. It's not for or against memory. Memory is important. We all need to remember. But my first teacher was incredibly absent-minded. Incredibly absent-minded. My second teacher, not so much. Not so much. So it's that's why mindfulness, I much prefer bare awareness, as I've said before, bare attention to mindfulness. And what Zen teachers teach, what my teacher taught, really, was how to find happiness in being, in just being. It's too simple. We want to be someone, we want to be something, we want to be calm, we want to be this, we want to be that, we want to be the other. And of course, that can't really be retaught. My teacher didn't really teach me to do that. I said he was my teacher. They were both my teachers. How could they teach me to be? Any more than they could teach me to breathe. But they encouraged me. They supported me. They gave me some direction. They gave me some tips. that confuse me. Part of confusing you is a way to help you come back to being too. Not with a malicious intent, but with an intent to bring you back to where what this is right here, to this right here. Until you're able to fall into a big space. Who knows when you will fall into a big space? Suzuki Roshi said, as I've quoted many times, enlightenment is an accident. Practice is making you accident prone. Practice is making you accident prone. Some point, if you continue this satipatthana, if some point you continue this attentiveness to the present, this awareness, with close, firm, and steadfast focus, you'll fall into space. We can call it that. I don't know what it is. We can call it that. In Buddhism, we have the 12-fold chain of dependent co-origination. And that's the story that we perpetuate based on the past, into the future, all of our projections, based on all of our worrying, all of our learning, and that chain goes on and on. We perpetuate that. That's the life of neurotic ego. The life of neurotic ego perpetuating that. One link leads to another. Starting with our feeling of separation, aloneness. We can go through the whole chain. But there are two places where we can break the chain in particular. It's the seventh and eighth, between the seventh and eighth link and the eighth and ninth link. We can break it. But it's not exactly that we break it. It's that we fall into a large space. The seventh is sensation, pure sensation. The eighth is like or dislike based on my sensation, right? I'm sitting next to you in a retreat, and let's say that you're breathing very hard. And maybe you're even doing some other gross things, but we'll just leave it at that, okay? You're breathing very hard. So I have sensation. I have unpleasant sensation from that. And the next link in the chain after sensation is dislike or hatred. Yuck! Yuck! And then the next link is the ninth one. I want to get away from you. I want to get away from you. But if I'm really practicing satipatthana, there's a chance that between the seventh and the eighth, I'll fall into a huge space. And then, it doesn't matter. The breathing is quite okay. Quite okay. Even the other rude behavior is quite okay. It's just all part of it. Or maybe I've lost it. I'm already into the eighth. I'm already thinking, oh, God, you know, Marty. that's the dislike. But instead of running, as when the bell rings, finding another seat on the other side of the zendo, I stay with it. I go into the space that stays with it and doesn't run. It just stays because it's open. That open, original space that's always present. It's original not because it was before, but because it's original at this moment. Right? Right? So that's our practice. That's our practice. And according to the early literature, sati has the S-A-T-I again, has a characteristic of not floating away from the object of meditation. So if the object is your breathing, you don't float away from it. If your object is focusing your mind and your hands, cosmic mudra, you don't float away from it. You don't become, and again this is in the early writing, you don't become the hollow pumpkin that bobs up and down in the water. And the function of sati is not to lose sight of the object of attention or keep it always in view. And there are two main manifestations of sati in this ancient ancient literature. The first is that sati sets the mind face to face. So I had a friend years ago who when he wanted to talk to me, he and I start to go over there, he'd sort of gently push me so that I was looking directly at him, right? So I was directly with him. And he did it enough times that it became kind of aggravating for me. But that was about face to face. That was about just being there with this, face to face. And if it's our breathing that we're focusing on in our meditation, maybe we're focusing on abdominal breathing in our meditation, then the sensations in the abdomen, face to face with those. The tensions, the pressures after sitting for 40 minutes, boy, the abdomen is getting tight. Maybe there's some heat in there. Maybe there's some movement. Face to face with the object. And it doesn't matter what the object is. That's the way I teach you. I care less. Oh, this is the right way. This is the right way. Forget it. Oh, you can have a right way if you want. Everybody wants a right way. Right? But I don't think so. Face to face with the object of your meditation. That's the right way. Which Shikantaza is bare, just sitting there face to face with that. So that's the first manifestation. The second manifestation of sati is that it protects from attack by the poisons, like a doorkeeper who does not admit bad and destructive people. This is pre-Mahayana Buddhist. That's good. It's good stuff. It's important stuff. But it's pre-Mahayana. Protects from attack by the poisons like a doorkeeper which does not admit bad and destructive people. Now the poisons, of course, that at the center of the chain of dependent co-origination are the poisons. Our greed, our hatred, our ignorance, and all the things that are iterations of those. There are lists of poisons that are iterations of those that keep us going on the chain, keep the chain just churning really fast until, through our meditation, we begin to see it. Begin to see it. And then wait until something happens. And patana. Sati patana, right? Patana, close, firm, and steadfast. There are a couple of similes that are used in the ancient literature. No gap between two floor planks. Now, why they say that, I don't know. It must have had wooden floors, I guess. If there's a gap between two floor planks, dust and sand will get in. Dust and sand will get in. And the second simile is before they had matches, when you want to make a fire, you have to rub continuously. If you stop rubbing even for a moment, you're back to the beginning. Ever notice this in your meditation? How you're going along, it's kind of cool. Oh, you really got it. Then you lose it, and you lose it so much that you have to come back and start all over. It happens a lot. And the pa in patana is rushing, entering into, and spreading over the object of meditation. Rushing into it, entering it, and spreading over so that you can stay close and firm. So that's the way that sati patana is talked about. And I think that's pretty articulate. I think that's more articulate than we are in Zen. I like that. It's nice to be able to be articulate about something once in a while, especially something as vague and amorphous as Zen, right? And when we practice sati patana, we practice Zen, we practice meditation, in Vipassana, when the Vipassana people study sati patana in particular, in Vipassana, there is the process of R-A-I-D, or R-A-I-N. And this is recognition, acceptance, inquiry, and disidentification, or non-identification. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So let's recognition and acceptance. Suzuki Roshi, those of you who have read his books, he talks a lot about this, recognition and acceptance. So when I was sitting in an urban area for a long time, a really urban area with a huge busy street on it, which was one-way street, and I was sitting at rush hour, what I heard was mostly the street, mostly the cars, mostly the honking, mostly the shouting. So I recognized that. I had to recognize how that was interfering with my meditation, and then gradually able to accept it, able to incorporate it into my meditation, able to let it just be part of my meditation. And the heavy breathing, maybe I could even do that with Marty. That's possible. You just incorporate his heavy breathing into my meditation, into my zazen. Why not? We want to get somewhere in our meditation. But this is about being, not getting somewhere, you guys. Sorry. Sorry. Not about getting anywhere. And I had a friend before I became a teacher here, but I knew him quite well, and he was going through a really bitter divorce. And when things were at their most heated, it was time for a retreat here. And he didn't even want to do the retreat, but he'd signed up to do the retreat. So he just worked on accepting the floods of emotion that were coming in. Just recognizing them first. You have to recognize them, and then accepting them. And accepting all of the stories he was saying, all of the criticism of himself and his spouse that was coming out. Just recognize and accept. And he got through the whole session, and he said it was very helpful to him. Just to be there, just to be doing that, without getting swept away. And most of you know, especially if you're not really young, you know about Girl is in the Mist and Diane Fossey. So Diane Fossey, so what did Diane Fossey do? Diane Fossey sat still hour after hour with those girls. She went in with no weapons into their natural habitat. She was the first one who had done that. Nobody had ever done that before. There are all kinds of scientific research on gorillas, all kinds of books written. Nobody had just been in there and sat face to face with them without their preconception about what they learned and without a gun, without even something to push them away, just sat there with them. For 18 years she did that. I never saw the movie, but I read the book. 18 years! Can you imagine that? And what was learned about gorillas as a result of Diane Fossey's work? Wow! About their communication system, about the way they made it, about how they cared for each other, about how they protected their young. Nobody knew this stuff because we had only seen them either in captivity or when we had armor in front of us, and that's going to affect the environment, right? When we have guns, when we have sticks to poke at them. She did that. Recognition and acceptance. Very powerful. Very powerful, too. Although sometimes it doesn't seem powerful. It's just continuing to do it that gives it its power. So, recognition and acceptance. And then inquiry. So, you might say, and don't take this too seriously, but one might say that after you've got what we call a good seat in our meditation, and a good seat means that you're able to focus more than half the time, that you're not real fidgety, that you've got your meditation rhythm pretty much in place. You've got a good seat, and that to have a good seat, you've done quite a bit of acceptance. You have to do quite a bit of recognition and acceptance to develop a good seat. Does that make sense? Quite a bit. So when you've got a good seat, but don't believe it entirely. This is just, I mean, really, because then you'll be focusing on, but I have a good seat. Oh, shit, I have a bad seat, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Will I ever get a good seat, right? So please don't do that. That's just more chain building. When you have a good seat, you know, then it's good to get into inquiry. What is this? What is it? What's going on here? What are these feelings? What are these thoughts about my wife, whom I'm divorcing from? What are those thoughts? And then who has those thoughts? And the reason I think you need to have a good seat first is that you can really trip out on that stuff if you don't have a good seat. And it really should be a focus for deepening your meditation, not for tripping you out. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I think that's pretty important. I don't talk too much about it, but it's the literature is fraught with this. For instance, Zen it's the natural koan in Soto Zen. It's the natural the inquiry, the natural koan, the natural problem that comes up from in our life. Not necessarily from sitting, but just in our life, and so we don't need any extra riddles. We just have the riddle of our concern, of our question. That's a good enough of a riddle. So Basui, the Soto Zen teacher Basui, practiced for quite a while and developed a good seat, and then he began wondering to himself, well, who is recognizing and accepting? I mean, he just did that spontaneously. I've done all this. This stuff is still all coming up. And who is it? Who is recognizing it? Who's accepting it? And this rose from the depths of his longing for some resolution, for some quiescence, for some real manifestation of the Zen mind. So that became his quest, and then he fell into a big space. So we all have our natural koan, and you know, it could be why am I miserable? How do I find real peace? How do I change my attitude towards so and so when so and so doesn't want to have anything to do with me? So many different things. Where does this thought come from? What's real? What do I really want in my life? What do I really want in my life? All people have some questions like this. Most people either repress or suppress or deny or just sort of give up hope. But we all have a natural calm, a natural So that's good. That's a tool. We don't need any additional riddles, any additional cons. It's good to look at those, but the riddle of our what we're doing, what we want to be doing. So at some point, as an exercise, you might want to just be quiet and write down question that. Or concerns that really, really are important to you. And then come back to the most important one. What's the most important one? I mean, life is short, right? How old are you now? How much more time do you have? Really? How much more time do you have? What's really vitally important to you? And when you've done a little bit of recognition and acceptance, then make it the focus of your zazen, of your meditation practice. It'll happen if you just allow it to happen. You don't really even have to force it. So I had a friend named Edward, and Edwards' natural con, his natural his problem, his question was, why do I have so much anger? A lot of my guy friends have had this, is there? And, you know, I don't know why my guy friends, but more my guy friends. Well, they don't usually have it as a question. They just emote it. But this guy, this guy had it as a question, right? Why do I have so much anger? So he tried externally, moving away from the urban areas. How many of you tried moving away from the urban areas? Moving to the bucolic, nice country area, natural foods, right? All that stuff. No television. He tried that. It didn't work, Rick.
He tried it 2 years ago.
Oh, it didn't help much. It didn't help much. Oh, then so then internally, you know, therapy, massage. Back then, encounter groups. It was a while ago, you guys. you know, all that stuff. Well, through that, he learned to at least control his anger, so he was just wasn't emoting over everyone and everything. He could see it and he could control it, but still, he had anger at his core, at the core of his sort of psyche. He felt angry at politics of the world, the way people treated each other, capitalism. But then it really got into his own relationships with others and with himself. So then he went to practice Zen in San Francisco with Suzuki. And Suzuki Roshi had a very simple approach, said, well, just sit. He said, Suzuki Roshi said, oh, you can do all that other stuff, live in the country and or live in the city, be in therapy or not be in therapy, but just sit. Do that stuff if you want to. Just sit. So Suzuki worked with him in a just simple way on recognition and acceptance, but not talking about it, just in sitting. A little bit of talking when things would come up. A little bit of pointing the finger when things had come up to what was going on. So he could just accept it, so he didn't have to think his zazen was awful when the anger came up. So he could just accept it, just see it, and then he kind of moved to, you know, what's the source of this anger? What's it coming from? And then ultimately to, who am I? This is the really, who am I? Who has this anger? Who is this? Who has it? And so, during a retreat, on the last night of a retreat, when he was sitting up late at night, because he was really wanted to deal with this issue, really wanted to deal with it, he fell into a space in which he no longer identified with anger. He totally disidentified with it. The anger came up, but it wasn't his, so he didn't have to do anything about it. And when you disidentify, when you fall into a space, that emotion loses its power over you completely. It just deflated. It's still there, but it loses its power. Or that, whatever it is, that obsession, or that compulsion, it just loses its power. And then even this bare awareness that he was practicing, he saw wasn't even his. It's not my bare awareness. I'm not practicing bare awareness. He disidentified with bare awareness. As long as you're identifying with bare awareness, you're trying to be someone. You're trying to practice bare awareness. But disidentification is just being, not being someone. Being someone at all, because you already are someone. You already are someone. Some wonderful whole being Buddha nature person, just as you are. this didn't solve all his life problems. This doesn't solve all your life problems, you guys. But in ensuing days and weeks and months, when his anger would come up, he could quite easily disidentify by saying, "Not mine, not mine." Not just very simply, very simply. In most situations, but not in all, because we're human. Because just being is not some perfect state. Not some perfect state. Something that's perfect is dead anyway, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, about a week or two after my friend had this experience, I saw him again. He had been a pretty close friend of mine, and by then the scuttlebutt was out that he'd had this experience. In the monastic situation, in like a, this was a Tassajara, oh, everybody knows what happens to everyone else, because people are always talking. You know, there's no talking at all, and then everybody's always talking. I always thought, how do they know what's going on? Where are they talking? It's true. True. I still don't get it, though, actually. Anyway, so I found out, oh. So I said to oh, Edward, let's go for a walk. Oh, sure. And I said, gee, wow, what's it like to be enlightened? I said something like this, you know. Which I had the braveness to do, even though in Soto we weren't supposed to talk about this. Like in Rinzai, you talk about it all the time. In Soto, right? And he said something to me like this. Something like this. He said, enlightened? He said, I don't have any sense about enlightenment or being enlightened. He said, he said, as I'm walking with you, it's quite wonderful. One leg is following the other. One leg is leading the other. And that's basically all he said to me. And that's just being, isn't it? That's not trying to have a wonderful Tai Chi gait all the time. Because it's just being. And if in just being, one leg always will follow the other. It just happens. It just happens. So that's my mission in being here with you guys, is to help you fall into that space and let that space become natural for you in your lives. But I don't think it'll go on our mission statement, because they'll want something that, you know, means something, I guess. Right, Dan? Dan's on the committee with me as the board chair. But this does mean something. It does mean something. So that's what I want to say for today, guys. Questions? Comments? Yeah. Oh. Well, let's see. Tried to confuse me. Well, I'm not sure they intentionally... I can think of two examples. One example would be Katagiri Roshi here. We were in the middle of a retreat, and I don't know how many day retreat it was, but he had asked me to give a talk or a series of talks in Dokusan for after the retreat was over. And I was downstairs going to the bathroom. I finished going to the bathroom, and I was going upstairs, and he was coming down, and this was just after he talked to me about this, and he said, "Think." Me. Well, that really confused me. I was really confused by that. Here we're in the middle of a retreat and he wants me to think. But I was also sort of, at that time in my life, kind of anti-thinking. In Zen, we get into anti-thinking. Thinking gets put down. We get into anti-thinking. So we're trying to be free from our thoughts. And so he was confusing me. It confused me. But it was also a good teaching. Good teaching. Yeah. Does that make sense? And I could probably think of a bunch of others. Is that enough? Or do you want me to think of another? Okay. Other people? Yeah.
Something you said right at the beginning of your talk was a little confusing to me. You said, talking about the mission statement, that your mission was to enable people to enjoy being.
Yeah.
And doing jobs in practice was a means to that. But
yeah.
But when you say that's a means, isn't that kind of like doing it in order to get something?
Oh, yes. That's what Dogen would say. Dogen would be very critical of this separation of the means and the ends. He would say, get out of here, Tim. I don't want you in my Zendo. But... but I'm hanging out anyway. And yes, of course. Ultimately, there's no separation between the means and the end. And if we focus on the... See, if Zazen becomes the means of getting somewhere, then we're not in being. Then we're trying to be something, trying to be calm, trying to be in being. So there is no separation between the means and the end. And yet, there also is a means and an end. I mean, we do things with a purpose. We have a means and there is an end. But it's very important that you bring that up that other side, Larry, because that's the essence of Dogen's teaching. Thank you. Thank you. Other people.
Can you identify the difference between disliking a sensation and a gatekeeper? Keeping out.
Oh, yes, well, yes, that's a good point. Of course, in our practice, the way we keep it out is by not trying to keep it out, but by being present and attentive to what's going on. That's the way we're the gatekeeper. That gives me the opportunity to fall into the space. If I just pay attention to this unpleasant sensation, this series of... I'm sorry, Marty, maybe you won't sit next to me next time.
I should never sit here.
If I just pay attention to these series of unpleasant sensations I'm getting from Marty, I'm just attentive to them. That's keeping the gate from turning into making something out of it, making a huge story out of it, a huge... that's just being. So gatekeeper, yeah. So that's a limitation to that term. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Oh, I have a funny story.
Okay, a funny story.
This was a session being held in by the sangha that I was connected with in Chicago. And there was a woman who was participating in the session, was having a lot of trouble with constipation. And so she wrote a note to the monitor asking, could she please have some prunes? And this went on, I think, for a day or two. And finally, a decision was made, yeah, we'll cook up some prunes for this poor woman. And they did that, prepared them. And then the monitor, oh, maybe it was a different person on this particular day, but he actually got confused about which person it was who was requesting the prunes. So another woman got tapped out of the sitting and brought all the way up to what's called the Vulture's Peak, which is on the third floor of the Zen Center, by the monitor. And unbeknownst, she had no idea what was going on, but she was led into this room and presented with this dish of prunes. That's the end of the story.
Well, you're not going to tell us about the aftermath, huh? Okay, well, thank you.